Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
The story of the UK is an economy that has got real momentum.
What is broken can be repaired. What is ruined can be rebuilt.
UK inflation is becoming much more homegrown.
We have huge potential as an economy in the UK.
This is a time to tell Israel there is a path to peace.
Our plan for the British economy is working, but the work is not done.
Hello, you're listening to Bloomberg UK Politics. I'm Caroline Hepke.
And I'm James Walcock. So, Caroline, we're coming off yesterday's Bank of England decision to hold rates at 5.25%, but that wasn't the whole story. It's worth saying, for those of us who don't spend all day watching the Bank of England, it works a slight topsy-turvy world to political reality. So when they say things are good, that inflation is coming down, that also means there is a bit of a concern about growth and a potential recession that we find ourselves in. Now, obviously, the bank says we might be coming out of recession quite soon. Mm. It's not all sort of bad news. But when you hear someone like Rishi Sunak, who's out campaigning today, maybe saying that the economy is great, it's worth saying here that, like, some people's views don't change quite as fast as us here in the markets update our forecasts.
No, absolutely not. Having said that, the latest consumer figures measured by GfK were quite positive, and we are feeling more upbeat about our own financial position, more upbeat than we have done since December 2021. And the retail sales figures for the first couple of months also came out today. They were reasonably strong. But no, you can hardly say that the UK is in a great position. I mean, inflation is still running very, very high, even if it's expected to come down. I mean, we're in a tricky, tricky position still.
And broadly, even then, while those figures are good, and those are consumer and sales related figures, and for what it's worth, employment, which I think is a much harder stat, is also doing very well.
Yeah.
Let me give you another one, something that people who vote will feel very keenly. The share of children living in absolute poverty in the UK has risen by its highest rate in 30 years, and that is 25% of children are living below the absolute poverty line. That comes from charities who are calling on the government to urgently overhaul welfare. Now, any family who has exposure to that, maybe relatives, you will be certain that will be in their mind as they vote, as much as interest rates will be as well. So, this is what we in the central bank watching business call a pivot. Have a listen to Bank of England Governor Andrew Bailey.
Yeah, we don't have to actually get inflation all the way back to target sustainably to cut rates, for instance, because what we have to do is be convinced that it is going to go there. You know, we should act ahead of time in that sense because we have to be forward looking.
Did you catch that? We don't have to get inflation to target. We can look ahead. Those words from Bailey had markets thinking the central bank is planning on cutting interest rates a fair bit sooner than most would have thought a few months ago. So joining us now is a friend of the show and the man we turn to explain the twists and turns of central bank policy, our senior economy reporter, Phil Aldrich. Phil, at a basic level, what did the bank say yesterday and why does it matter?
The headline was that they held rates at 5.25%. But what made it an interesting meeting was that there was a big shift on the committee itself. There were two who were voting for rate hikes until yesterday, and now there are none voting for rate hikes. There's one voting for a rate cut. That was the same as before, Swati Dhingra. And then of the eight who held, the minutes said there were a few who believed that there was, you know, interest rates were having a material impact on bringing inflation down, and not only that, bringing the underlying domestic inflationary pressures down as well, which is another signal that there are some members within that hold group who believe that the interest rates are doing enough. Plus, they added this quite interesting extra line to the guidance. So the guidance has been that policy needs to remain restrictive, and restrictive would normally mean that, you know, we're going to have to raise rates or we're at least going to have to hold rates. But then they added this point that restrictive can mean cutting rates, because even when we cut rates, their rates will still be higher than they should be in terms of higher than what they believe the neutral level is, so that they're still bearing down on inflation. So suddenly restrictive means you're cutting rates as well. So they've got, basically, they've just completely sort of redefined what they can do.
Effectively, here. Does that then mean that they are expecting to cut rates quite soon? Is that what the market's saying? And will that boost the economy?
So the market's saying June at the earliest. I think that's probably the right call. The obviously, the politics of this is that, you know, you get, if you cut rates, you are going to get, in theory, a boost to the economy. There's lots of mortgage holders who are remortgaging still. Mortgage rates aren't actually based off bank rate. The fixed rate deals are actually based off the market, some, you know, market rates. And so those have already come down. But if the Bank of England is actually bringing rates down, you know, that is going to help, you know, help ensure that mortgage rates are not going to continue to cause more household pain than necessary. So it will have a, it will have a, an effect on both businesses and on consumers as they bring rates down.
Okay, let's think about this from the political perspective. I mean, obviously the Bank of England is independent and is now in this awkward position, of course, because we're coming up to a general election or in general election year. In terms of cutting interest rates, will that help Rishi Sunak? Will it help the Conservatives in time for an election? Lots of discussion around that.
Yeah, so obviously the key thing is they have to get inflation. They have to show that they're going to get inflation back to target. The bank is now actually saying inflation will be below 2% in April. That is going to make it very hard for them to push back against the idea that they're going to cut rates very shortly. They are pointing out, and even Hunt, the Chancellor Jeremy Hunt, was saying yesterday that there are these underlying pressures of inflation, which obviously the bank must keep an eye on. So he's being sympathetic to the bank position. Yeah, that cutting rates ahead of an election is going to be, is potentially a politically awkward thing to do for an institution that is independent. And you can look back through the independence era since 1997, and the bank has only cut rates after an election was called, so after the campaigns effectively start in 2001, and that was 2 days after the campaign was the election was called. They had already been cutting. So this was a continuation of what they were already doing. But then in the subsequent month, in June 2001, the vote was held the day before the election itself, and the bank paused. So you do get a sense, and from looking back at the historical record, that the bank is alert to the fact that should it start cutting rates after the campaign is called, that is not going to be a particularly good look. The Tories will say, the government will say, look, we're doing the right thing, and Labour could start saying, you know, isn't it a bit odd that the Bank of England seems to be, you know, supporting one side in this election where everyone should be neutral. So you just don't want to get into that kind of debate. So you need to get yourself set up to be able to cut rates beforehand. And we're expecting, you know, Hunt has hinted that the election would be in October, which would mean that start of September, the campaigns would be starting. So you've got to move before then.
Just to sort of introduce a note of scepticism here, Phil, like the bank has become almost totemic, with people like Liz Truss saying it's, you know, the fault of everything that goes wrong with her policies. Jeremy Hunt, on the other hand, claiming credit for, you know, the government's work getting it down. But we live in a very globalised world. We also are tied to sort of the Fed. The Ukraine war has impacts on our prices. Natural gas prices have been falling out of the inflation figures. How much weight should we really give the Bank of England in sort of the UK's economic picture? Is it the be-all and end-all, or is it like a small part of a much bigger puzzle?
Well, on the inflation, it is such an interesting thought, because Archie Norman, when Caroline and I were interviewing him a few weeks ago, he said that basically bank rates, you know, Bank of England seem to have done pretty much nothing in terms of the interest rates have not really done much on the inflation. Inflation was coming down because of those global forces, etc. And actually, Bailey, in his interview with the FT today, he says that this is very unusual because we have managed to effectively engineer a soft landing. Inflation is going to hit the 2% target by April, which is forecast by pretty much everyone. And yet there's not going to have been any material increase in inflation, in unemployment. So how much can you ascribe to the Bank of England of this success? That there is this sort of underlying issue of, like, if they hadn't done, if there's a counterfactual thought, if they hadn't pushed back against inflation, then you might have seen inflation just take off, because everyone would think there was no restraining mechanism. But obviously the big drivers of the fall in inflation, and therefore the success of bringing cost of living down, etc., has been global forces. The, you know, food prices have fallen, supply chains have improved, and obviously the big one is the energy price drop.
Yeah, absolutely. He talks about effectively disinflating at full employment. So for the full kind of jargon, yeah, it is a very interesting moment. I think a lot will be written kind of historically about this particular moment where we've seen inflation, but very much kind of driven by global forces. really interesting to get your views then on the Bank of England as we look ahead, yes, to the all-important timing then for when the Bank of England cuts interest rates. Does look like it's definitely pointing that way now. Our UK senior UK economy reporter, Phil Aldrich. So that's the economic picture then for the UK. Still not great. So then would you fork out for a football strip for you or for the kids £124.99? Have you seen this?
I don't think I'd fork out £124. There aren't many items of clothing I would fork out £124. Full stop, Caroline.
Well, this is not just the cost. This is the Nike's New England Euros 2024 kit. So it's £125 just about for the adults kit, £120 for kids. There is a cheaper version, the stadium version, which is a little bit less.
I think I'm the cheaper version. Just full stop.
Yeah. It's not just the price, though, that is controversial, because Nike's also launched this updated strip for the England men's football kit, which is for the Euro 2024 tournament that starts in June. It has stirred up controversy because of what Nike has called a playful update to the St. George's Cross. So they've added navy, light blue and purple to the traditional red on white flag. This is also at the back of the collar, basically. Keir Starmer is calling on the company to reconsider the design, saying that the flag doesn't need to be changed. And he's been joined by a lot of other Westminster voices, including the Culture Secretary Lucy Fraser and the Shadow Attorney General Emily Thornberry, who have criticised the kits.
I mean, look, English football has always been interesting. It exists in this intersection of sports, identity, with a big dollop of politics as well. The Prime Minister waded into the space recently with a football governance bill aimed at regulating the game. I mean, joining us now to discuss that interesting relationship between football and society is pundit, executive and former England player Eniola Aluko. Eniola, what do you make of the design?
I mean, I think we live in a world where brands are changing kits all the time, you know, in a playful, fashionable way that is to be worn by many diverse groups of people who support the England team. You know, it's not a surprise to me to see this. The England team, particularly the men's team, is incredibly diverse and incredibly inclusive. So why would a flag, you know, a playful update on a flag not reflect that? I think what we're seeing is what's happening in the UK right now, which is just very sort of polarised, divisive, nationalistic sentiments coming out against any form of inclusivity or any form of diversity that is prominent in sports. That's what I think this is about.
Hmm. So you don't agree then with, you know, Keir Starmer saying that actually it's not something that the fans want? Others have said this, that it's not something that the fans are looking for. You disagree with that?
Well, I mean, I don't think a lot of shirts have always been created based on what the fans want. You know, it's, you know, Nike have decided to design this based on unifying fans. And, you know, I think what we're hearing is certain fans don't want it. You know, because I'm an England fan, that doesn't represent me. I think it's fine. So I think we give prominence sometimes to what certain fans are saying and not what others. Mm. If you did a whole poll of England fans across the country, it might turn out that people aren't bothered about the playful update.
I feel like we've identified the two sort of words that matter here, which are representation and unity. Because, I mean, Keir Starmer, he told The Sun that this sort of symbol is a unifier, sort of the original, unplayed with sort of St. George's Cross. And you say, kind of in some ways, it's about representing the Nike sort of symbol is trying to represent a broader array of people. I mean, this is kind of the question of what is that relationship between identity and symbols? I don't know, like, do you think that the flag needs to remain the same to speak to a broader range of people? Or do you feel that, like, this was a completely understandable thing to do? Because, I mean, do you see what Keir Starmer is aiming at there?
Well, I think Keir Starmer would also understand that the flag, the St. George's flag, in the way that it the original St. George's flag, actually creates a certain negative emotion for some people too, right? In terms of, you know, the nationalistic connotations to it. Now, you know, I live in England and have done my whole life as a black woman. Sometimes that flag has been used, you know, to to support racist sentiments against me. So at the end of the day, you know, whether it's the original St. George's flag or the updated version that is meant to unify and represent diversity and inclusion for what is a diverse and inclusive United Kingdom, whether people like it or not, we have a diverse and inclusive United Kingdom full of people who represent the country, who are not, you know, who are, you know, immigrants, including the people who play on the pitch and represent England. Mm. So I don't see why this is so far off it. The people on the pitch, the England men's team on the pitch, who everybody's going to be supporting in the summer, are made up of a diverse range of men. The flag represents that.
Okay. And indeed, I think it is, you know, quite a fascinating fact. I mean, one in six people in the UK now are people, you know, who started life somewhere else, born somewhere else, and are now in the UK. So the UK is a very diverse country, as you say. You played under the St. George's Cross 102 times. How important to you then is it as a symbol? Because, you know, is it meaningful? Does it raise something important for you that it's changed? Is it, you know, how do you see that? Were you uncomfortable using that flag? As you say, a lot of people see the St. George's Cross, as you say, is sometimes quite conflicted.
Well, I was very proud to represent England. You know, I don't want to make it, I want to be very clear about that. I was very proud to play for England. And, you know, the flag was something that I wore on my shirt very proudly, like everybody else. It wasn't something, though, that I felt could never, ever be changed. You know, passport colours just changed recently, and, you know, we all had to get on with it. I think, you know, whether the flag stays in its original state, whether it changes, I think ultimately there's a deeper issue here, which is diversity and inclusion in the United Kingdom. And some, you know, Nike is making an attempt to reflect that. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I don't think that things changing should mean that, you know, it should never be done. The flag has changed. It's a playful update to represent diversity and inclusion in this country. The players on the pitch represent that too, by the way. And I think it's healthy. I think it's important to reflect that. Now, if they want to change it back to the original colour, fine. I mean, you know, there's lots of people that think that's great too. But let's not, you know, demonise diversity and inclusion. Let's not keep demonizing those changes, because it's very dangerous when you start saying anything that represents diversity and inclusion is woke, anything that represents diversity and inclusion is bad. That makes somebody like me, a black woman who's represented England 102 times, feel negative. That's a negative message to somebody like me.
And indeed, it's subtle, isn't it? It's quite layered, because Nike also says this is both about inclusivity and about diversity, but also about throwing back and recalling England's history, because they've talked about those colours being the training gear that was worn by the 1966 England World Cup winning team, at least in their training. So they also kind of have brought in a number of elements. So it's layered, isn't it, James?
It is. I mean, they would sort of point to that kit being sort of a historical thing before they would bring up diversity, Caroline. I mean, any other, look, you are an extremely storied England player, but you're also a football executive. You know, you have a career outside of just playing the game. Do you see this as good business for Nike and for the England team?
Well, I think that will depend on the amount of people that want to buy the shirt without, you know, not necessarily, you know, having any opposition to the change of the flag. I mean, that's yet to see. I know there's a petition out against this. But, you know, I think sometimes we amplify the loud minority, forgetting that actually there's lots of people like me who don't really, you know, don't put that much emphasis on the flag on the back of the shirt. We just support England, as we always have done, and we support the diverse players on the pitch, and that's what they represent. So whether it's a good business case, I don't know. But look, in sport, shirts are updated all of the time. Mm. Like, literally all the time. So
get it into perspective.
Like, oh, my God. Yeah, like, it's not like, oh, my God, what are Nike doing? Like, they've changed the shirt, like, as football shirts are changed all the time. And guess what? When football shirts are changed, lots of fans sometimes don't like it, and they make that known. You know, this feels no different to me. It just seems like there's quite a nationalistic element to it that I think we need to really, really, really be careful of.
Yeah. Look, this kit is for the Euros 2024. Now, the last championship saw England players like Marcus Rashford receive a torrent of racist abuse after England lost in that final. Do you think that, how much is English football moving on with its problem with racism? There was a lot of support for Rashford, but the racist abuse was so significant. How much is that changing, do you think, in English football?
I don't think it's changing. I think it's still there. And you wouldn't be surprised that, you know, if we were to do an analysis of the same people who are, you know, very angry about the diversity inclusive flag are the same people that probably go to England games and when Marcus Rashford or Bukayo Saka misses a penalty, racially abuse him. I think there's a link there. And that's just the reality. That's the stone cold reality of it. Now, what happens to those people when they decide to racially abuse English players is what I care more about. So punishments, consequences, bans. You can never come to an England game again. If you're online racially abusing players, you will be arrested, and the digital police will find you. That's what I care about, and that's where I think progress has to be made and continue to be made to make sure that we are punishing and we are highlighting that there is no tolerance whatsoever for racism against England players who represent the country.
Any other... I want to come back to something you were saying about who this whole conversation is speaking to, and you were saying you weren't sure that Keir Starmer is speaking to black women like you. We've been talking a lot on this podcast in recent weeks about the position of women of colour in public life. You know, we've recently seen comments from Tory donor Frank Hester about Diane Abbott. We've seen the Doreen Lawrence saying that she, as Labour's race advisor, doesn't feel listened to. Do you feel, to ask you directly, that Keir Starmer is speaking to people like you?
Yeah, I think Keir Starmer, I like Keir Starmer. I think a lot of what he has said in terms of what the direction of the country is, you know, I agree with it. It's valid. I think when it comes to race relations, there's probably more agreement across party than there is disagreement. And I think the recent recognition that actually it is absolutely unacceptable to have a Tory donor, Frank Hester, suggesting that Diane Abbott, a black woman in public life, should be shot. That in itself means that I feel safe, or safer, that politicians are calling it out for what it is and are suggesting that consequences need to come of it. So, there are always things that you'll disagree on with politics, and there's some things you agree on. And that's where I stand with Keir Starmer. You know, I think there's some great things that he says. On this occasion with regards to the flag, I don't agree, because I don't think there's anything wrong with representing diversity and inclusion in the UK. It's a very important issue. And as I said, to go back to it, the players on the pitch that we're going to be cheering represent diversity and inclusion.
And on that, though, this whole debate, you yourself have faced a lot of abuse in the public just in recent weeks. In fact, we've seen, you know, MPs like Diane Abbott do get massive amounts of public abuse. As a high profile, successful black woman, do you think we need to change the way we have these kinds of conversations, especially as we head into a general election where there's going to be massive amounts of social media conversations, lots of abuse, fake news thrown around? Do you think we need to have a conversation about how we address that, deal with it, what kind of laws there are around it?
Well, I don't actually think you can deal with these things without calling it out and without amplifying it to some extent. That's the only way that the people guilty of it are held responsible. So it's part of my strategy and tactic often, particularly online, to expose these people and to say, well, you know, here we are, this man or this woman has said, you know, this racist thing to me. Have a look at it. Everybody have a look. Mm-hmm. And then that person, you know, quickly deletes their account or deletes the comment. So, you know, in life, if you do something wrong and you face the consequences of it, everybody else looks at that and goes, well, I'm not going to do that. And that's where we're at. You know, it is too easy at this moment in time, particularly on X, on social media, to racially abuse, use sexist and misogynistic language towards black women. The only way to deal with that is to identify who these people are hiding behind these accounts, to call it out, and so everybody understands what racism is and everybody understands what sexism and misogyny is, and hold those people responsible and accountable.
Eniola Aluko, thank you so much for being with us, the football pundit, executive, and of course the former England player then on Nike's new kit for the England squad for Euro 2024. Well, that's it from us for today. If you like the programme, don't forget to subscribe and give it 5 stars so that other people can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.
This episode was produced by Mia Dawkins and Tiwa Adebayo, and our audio engineers were Marufal Hussain and Sean Guastamacchia. I'm James Wilcock.
And I'm Caroline Hepker, and we'll be back with more on Monday. This is Bloomberg.
Bloomberg UK politics. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB digital radio in London.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.